nice to have people. So, in the Gateless Barrier, the Mumon Khan, case 35. Okay, let's see. There we go. Wu Tzu asked a monk, "The woman Qin and her spirit separated. Which is the true Qin?" So this is a Zen teaching story from one of our collections of teaching stories. And it's one that I've been working with ever since I started sitting. So I thought it would be a good time to revisit and see where we are now. It is based on a traditional folk story from China. It's kind of a ghost story. So I'd like to tell it, because otherwise that doesn't make any sense. Qin and her soul are separated. What's that about? In Japanese, she's called Seijo. So sometimes you'll hear this story about Seijo, but it's the same person. So she, this is, again, this is a folk tale. So she was a woman, a young woman, who lived in a village with her father. And when she was growing up, when she was a little girl, actually, there was a boy in the village, and they were really, really good friends. They loved each other so much. They played together a lot. And her father used to joke and say, "Oh, you two are going to get married someday." So they always figured they were partners. They were going to be together. Well, then when she got older, you know, her father hadn't really meant that, and he picked out a husband for her, and she was going to have to get married to this other person. And she was just heartbroken because her true love was this, her friend. And I guess he was pretty bereft too, and so he just started going off in the night to get on a boat and leave the village, because I don't think he could stand his sweetheart marrying somebody else. And she ran off after him. She left her father, she left the village, she ran off after him, she got into the boat and went off with him. And they lived a life together. They had children. They got married. I don't know if they got married or not, but they were together. I may be embellishing the story a little bit, but that's allowed with folk tales. So she lived her life. She was having a fruitful, happy, good life with her love and her children, but there was some nagging voice in the back of her head that was like, "Ah, oh, my dad, the village, my obligation, my other life, oof." And finally, after a while, that call just got so strong that she just said, "You know, I need to go home. I need to go back home. I need to return." And so they went back to the village, and I think she stayed back, and her husband went down, her love, down into the village and went to apologize to the father for having taken his daughter away. And he said, "You know, I'm so sorry, you know, Qin, you know, she went off with me." And the father said, what are you talking about? What do you mean?" He said, "Well, what do you mean?" He goes, Qin is, she's been in a coma ever since you left. She's in the hut. She's been in a coma ever since you went off." "No, it's impossible." And by this time, Qin had come down from the boat, and the husband was kind of looking, and the father was looking, and the Qin got out of the coma and came walking out of the hut. And the Qin from the boat came walking down into the village, and they saw each other. And one of the versions of the story is that then they became one. Okay, so that's the story. And I want to talk about elements in the story, because this is one of the ways we approach studying these teaching stories, as we look at the different aspects of the stories. And we consider, how does this relate to me? How does this relate to my life, to my understanding? But then there's also the koan, what the teacher said. It's not just the story, but the koan is, which is the true Qin? And I want to talk about that part too. So, of course, I forgot to bring a clock again. So either somebody could loan me a watch, or That would be great, because I do like to be sure and leave time for discussion. Thank you very much. Okay. So, you know, the first part of this story that I think strikes many of us, maybe not all of us, but certainly many of the people I speak with when we are talking about our lives, is this feeling of being divided. That's kind of the first sort of obvious element of this story that many of us can relate to. You know, am I a wage-earning consultant, or am I a poet and an artist and a Zen priest? You know, that's one of my koans. Tomorrow I'm going to get in my car and my work clothes and drive up to Hayward and work with the superintendent of a school district. And, you know, is that the real me, or is this the real me? Which is the real me? Is it that one or this one? Is it this robe, or is it whatever outfit I'm going to put on tomorrow to go up there? You know, I have a person I'm very close to who wonders often, am I a mother or am I a monk? Which is, you know, which is the true me? I know we talk about this sometimes too, Lori. I don't remember exactly what you're, you know, am I, how do I know when my wishing to take a break is because I'm a lazy, no good for nothing, or because I'm a wise person who needs to take a break? You know, these ways that that we feel divided often. So that's one thing to consider. But then, you know, the other part here is there's the call. There's the call to return is one of the calls. So very often when people are interpreting this story, I read actually some old lectures, an old lecture that Catherine had given, commenting on this story. And I read in The Hidden Lamp, Linda Ruth has a commentary also on this story. And both of them had kind of mentioned this element of the call to return as like a call to wholeness, you know, a call to not just be the one who's out in the world, but also the one who, you know, home, like your true home. Do you ever feel a calling for your true home? And what is your true home? The call to home, the call to wholeness, the call of the body. Sometimes our bodies call us, maybe through aches and pains or mysterious sensations, emotional turbulence. Some part of us is calling us to listen to it, to pay attention, not to ignore it. There's a wonderful teacher, not from the Zen tradition, but one of Trungpa's heirs, Reggie Ray. I've been studying him quite a bit, and he talks about this aspect that our bodies themselves and our somatic world is something that, for a lot of us, it's not something that we really pay a lot of attention to. And so there's this sense of something that's missing. And then we hear the call of the body, and it calls us back into this yearning for wholeness. Talk a little bit more about that later. But then there's another call in this story. And I really want to also shine the light on that. And that's the call to leave. And I think the call to leave is just as sacred as the call to return. Because I think sometimes, for example, Shakyamuni Buddha, you know, he was called to leave his home. He had a comfortable home. He had a beautiful wife. In his case, it was almost like the opposite of Qian. He was called to leave by his curiosity about yearning for wholeness of understanding the wholeness of the human condition, because he had been kept from seeing the wholeness of the human condition by his father, who was trying to protect him from suffering. But when he saw and heard about old age and suffering and sickness and death, he said, I need to know about this. So he left. So this call to leave, I think I don't think the story is just, you know, she went and then she had to become whole and so she returned. I think that's part of it. But I also think part of her wholeness was listening to her heart and leaving. And this brings to mind a beautiful story that I know Jean often in our life makes reference to. It's an old story from one of the writings of Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, who wrote The Little Prince, was one of his famous books, but also Wind, Sand, and Stars. And I think this is one of the most beautiful descriptions of the spiritual aspect of the call out, not just the call in, but the call out and beyond. So I'll read it to you. This is by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. When the wild ducks or the wild geese migrate in their season, a strange tide rises in the territories over which they sweep. As if magnetized by the great triangular flight, the barnyard fowl leap a foot or two into the air and try to fly. The call of the wild strikes them with the force of a harpoon, and a vestige of savagery quickens their blood. All the ducks on the farm are transformed for an instant into migrant birds and into those hard little heads till now filled with humble images of pools and worms and barnyards. There swims a sense of continental expanse, of the breadth of seas and the salt taste of the ocean wind. The duck totters to the right and left in its wire enclosure, gripped by a sudden passion to perform the impossible and a sudden love whose object is a mystery. You know, and I've struggled with this sense a lot because I have this sort of escapist tendency. You know, I'm a good soldier. I've, you know, worked for 30 years and did my job and earned my money and paid my way, you know, and all that, all the time yearning to be writing, yearning to be in the zendo, you know, yearning to be painting, feeling divided, and yet not really having a choice because my life was just such that, you know, that's what just what I had to do. I just had to do both. And I used to think that that yearning, that escapist yearning was bad. You know, it's like you're worrying, am I lazy because I want to rest, you know? And I think that this story by Saint-Exupéry is just such a beautiful expression. What if that yearning that feels like escape is actually the yearning for freedom, is the yearning to be outside of the confinement of whatever box we're in? So I really think that even when we feel divided, sometimes what we have to do is just follow that which is calling. And I think that's what Chan did. She followed. First, she left. She followed her heart. She went out into the world. But then when the time came, she heard the other call. And, you know, then it was time to go back. And I think our lives offer us these different times where sometimes it's, you know, sometimes it's time to be the mom and sometimes it's time to be the monk. Sometimes it's time to be the priest and sometimes it's time to be the consultant or whatever different kinds of ways you might feel pulled and separate. There's another image. You know, I've collected these images trying to somehow validate this tendency that I have to try to jump the fence, you know, and feeling like it's non-Zen. It's not, I'm not being a good Zen student because, you know, I'm supposed to just be content with what is, and I'm supposed to just be content on my little cushion, and then I'm always yearning to jump the fence. So I've also cultivated gathering stories about that. And another concept that comes up for me in that regard that I think is a valuable one to consider is when I was reading about permaculture, which is ecological gardening theory. or theory practice, I don't know what you'd call it. But what we call weeds in the ecological, you know, kind of gardening culture, they're not called weeds. There's a term of called pioneer plants, and they're actually the most adaptable of the seeds because they can grow on very, very poor soil. You know, the fancier plants need richer soil to grow in. But, you know, like the dandelion, I mean, that's a classic one. I mean, you know, they take root and they grow anywhere. So these pioneer plants are the ones that push the edge of the ecosystem and begin to jump over into the new territory. And what they actually do is they create the biomass that then the more fussy, you know, sophisticated, developed plants can then have something to put their roots into. So I wrote one time in one of my writing, so what I'm realizing is that my feeling of fits and starts, of always beginning, of seeding, maybe I'm just trying to develop a more mature ecosystem. My weeds are my dreams and also my discontents. My pioneer plants trying to establish a foothold. So that flipping of thinking of it rather than a discontent and being bad, maybe it's this impulse to expand the territory and to take root somewhere and to make it possible for something else to grow. Because I think often we do get surprised when, you know, we're going along and we're struggling with these divided things and these dualities. And then all of a sudden one day, maybe you go, oh, wait a minute, you know, it's not such a problem anymore. I don't know, have any of you ever experienced that? Put up your hand if you've ever had that experience. I'm just curious. One person, two people. Three. Well, that feeling where there's something that you struggle with and you feel divided about it and you, and then one day you realize it's just not such a problem anymore. You know, how does that happen? How does that happen? And I think this begins to speak to the third part of this story, which is the question I think that the teacher is asking, which is the true Qian. I think that question is calling us into the realm of integration. You know, we can study the sides. We can study the Qian who went out in the world and had a family and the one who came back to the village. Or I can study my sides, my work over here, my work over here. But at some point, then, there's this possibility of the curiosity of, well, what is it that is the integration? What is the connection? And that is where I think that the question, which is the true Qian, begins to send us, if we really start thinking about it. You know, which is the true me? The one who's going to put on her work clothes tomorrow and drive to Hayward, or this one? As if they were separate. As if they were separate. I was so thrilled, as I think many of us were, to hear Shohaku Okamura's talk. But how many of you were there? About half of you? He talked a few weeks ago, and you know, he brought up this. We all have our questions of how a feeling of division, right? And for him, he talked about that even when he was very, very young, and he just was first exposed to Buddhist writings, that he read his teacher. Or heard his teacher talking about how, on the one hand, he called it group stupidity, where it's this tendency that we have to lose ourselves to groups and just follow blindly along and do what the group does and not actually think for ourselves. And he used that as an example that has led individuals and countries to really, really bad places. And he was using it in the sense of his own experience as a young man in Japan, you know, right after the Second World War, and that there was this real push for money making, and he really struggled with that because that wasn't his path, and he didn't really know how he was going to find himself in that very strong money making world. So Uchiyama, his teacher and and Sawaka Roshi, his teacher, were both quite critical also of this, what he called the money-making machine. And they called it group stupidity. And they said, you have to see things with your own clear eye. So there was that teaching. But then he also taught about the self that is connected to the whole universe, which lets go of the individual I. So he understood each of those teachings, but what he didn't understand was, but how can these both be true? On the one hand, here he is telling me to have a self and to think for myself and to see things with my own clear eye. And on the other hand, he's telling me to let go of myself and let go of the individual I and be the self that is connected with the universe. And he just puzzled over this. What? How old was he? Is he now? I mean, he was maybe, 18 when he encountered that teaching. So maybe 40, 50? Yeah, so, I mean, he has been thinking about this one for decades. And this is not uncommon in our practice. Dogen Zenji, our founder, he had his puzzle question. Wait a minute, if we're already enlightened already, why are we sitting? Why bother doing any of this if we're already enlightened? So I think sometimes we get these questions that seem like opposites, but somehow we're called to integrate them. And I think that's what this koan is asking us to consider. I think it's more than just she did this and then she heard the call and she went back and then, she merged. I think it's also inviting us to look at, well, what is the relationship? How do we make this connection? And to really hang out there and really feel our way into that. So I'd like to explore that for a little bit. Because I think that often when we're faced with these seeming dualities, I know for myself, somehow I imagine I'm going to figure out which one should I do? Which path should I go on? I somehow imagine that I'm going to figure it out by standing at the crossroads, thinking, ooh, which one should I do? Oh, I better make an analysis. Is this the better path or is that the better path? And I'm standing at the crossroads, so frustrated because I don't know what I'm supposed to do. But I don't think that's how we figure it out. I think we figure it out, you start walking. You start walking. You start walking, and you don't know. And you're following some instinct. And you're following, and you're walking on this path. But then you get that call. Oh, but what about this? And there we go. That's the dance. What about that? Maybe it's going to actually have me leave the path I'm on and go back to the village. Or maybe not. Maybe it's just going to be something that itches inside my head and my heart, and I'm going to keep walking on the path, and I'm going to let that itch happen. I'm going to let myself feel uncomfortable and keep holding this tension of these things that seem to be so opposite. But I'm going to stay engaged. Stay engaged, keep following the heart. And that's where then at some point, I think sometimes that's when you just realize, it's not separate anymore. Like for me now, actually, with this whole thing, am I a priest or am I a writer or am I a consultant? I've also been in the cracks writing about this experience for about 20 years. And it's starting to turn into a book, And I'm going, oh, that's really good that I didn't quit my job 20 years ago because I wouldn't have anything to write about. But it's also good that I didn't think that means I shouldn't be in the Zendo because then my work wouldn't have been grounded and connected with the Zen and the Buddhist path, which is actually what the writing is about. Mm-hmm. It's actually about both of these things. So I'm really glad I didn't make myself choose one over the other. And the integration, this thing that has felt so frustrating for so long is starting to feel actually kind of satisfying. So Catherine talked about this. Catherine Thanis, our Abbott, who passed away not too long ago. How long ago? 2 years ago? Something like that. Here's some of the things she said when she was talking in 1999 about this very koan. Chin and her soul are separated. She said, and when she said this in 1999, I totally didn't get it, I will confess. But I hung on to it because I resonated with it. So she said, the life conflicts that are as deeply engaging as the two possibilities presented in this story arise when the options we experience are equally powerful and meaningful, where both have a deep hold on us. How we meet this stasis or passage in our lives is to wait patiently, holding the two alternatives in mind until the holding and waiting and sitting and questioning resolve of themselves and the opposites become one. This is how we work with the koans of our lives. Apparent opposites become reconciled when we see they are only opposites in the mind, and that it is the discrimination of the mind that holds them in opposition. And then a little later, she talked about this aspect that I think I'm talking about now. She says, in my experience, we can't talk ourselves out of those parallel lives. We have to live them out in some way until in the living, the separation is healed. This is the stuff we work with, the competing drives, interests, purposes, goals, and practices to see which wither away as we practice and which get clearer and stronger. When we become clear, we don't have to make a choice. The choice is already made. So it's not standing at the crossroads and then the road is going to tell me which one is the right one. I'm only going to know that by walking. You know, that beautiful quote, Se hace el camino al andar by Machado. We make the path by walking. That's how this integration happens, is by engaging the stuff of our lives. And so when Reggie Ray talks about this in terms of the body and in terms of listening to the disconnected parts of ourselves, I think it's very much the same thing. And I think that working with our physical reality is a really good practice place for some of these ways that we feel divided. He says, the spiritual journey is not accomplished by disconnecting ourself from the relative reality of our lives. That's often one of the things that we feel is separate, you know, is that there's this higher state that we're somehow supposed to be living in, and then there's the actual relative reality of our messy lives. You know, the work, the kids, the mom, the dad, the neighbor, the, you know, all that stuff. The body, you know. The spiritual journey is not accomplished by disconnecting ourselves from the relative reality of our lives and attaining some higher state. Nor is the journey made by ignoring the actuality of our life and seeking a bypass, a journey around it, to some distant goal. The spiritual journey of the human person is made only by meeting our relative experience with absolute directness and complete nakedness, and by allowing relative reality to ground, inform, and guide us and bring about the transformation that we ultimately seek. So I would love to, at this point, we still have a fair amount of time, and while there are more things that I could talk talk about. I would love to hear where you are going inside of you with this material, and particularly if there's some ways that you yourself have struggled with and worked with feelings of separation and any kind of glimmers of calls or insights about this integration question that I think is a life journey question. I'd love to hear what some of your experiences have been or questions. Yes, Edie?
I think there's a character missing in the puzzle or the dialogue in the father, the one in the coma.
Ah.
What about that?
Wow.
Yeah.
That's great. I love it. Yeah, that's one of the characters in the story, too. The one who for years probably, you know, moistened her lips with water and felt all the feelings that he felt for his daughter that he loved so much, and there she was. Yeah, and I mean, you know, I mean, just at a kind of a first level of thinking about that, I'm thinking of psychological integration, you know, with all the parts of ourself that ultimately we really can't be separate from, and that we need to honor and acknowledge all the parts of us and all the beings who tended us and took care of us.
And the one that's in the coma.
And the one that's in the coma. That part of ourselves, too. Yeah.
This poem really interesting. I mean, I've heard this story so many times, and every time I hear it, there's something new for me. So 2 weeks ago, you and I were talking about this, and it's like, oh, I didn't know that they merged at the end. This is so important. That's the whole thing. They merged. And what I was experiencing 2 weeks ago is that it's not that there's this viewpoint or this viewpoint, but that it's a place of no more viewpoints. But this time, listening to a story, so that's the feeling of, well, this is the place to be. The merging is where you want to be. But this time I'm hearing, well, there's Chen that goes off with her love. There's Chen in the coma. And there's merging. Mm-hmm. Like, not as big. Like, it's just all equal.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of goes back to that very last sentence of something you said just now. They're just meeting what is right then. There's no place to be.
Mm-hmm.
No more important place.
Mm-hmm.
And each thing is valuable. Being in daily life is valuable.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't to be rejected.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I got.
Been there ever since, when he was describing his understanding of the middle way, the non-contradictory inclusion of opposites,
mm-hmm.
I think that's right,
mm-hmm.
Which is, it's not this and it's not that, and it's not this on top of that, or some amalgamation of this and that. It's a different level of integration.
Mm-hmm.
They're both included, and it's just the middle way. It's not a little bit of A and a little bit of B. It's unto itself completely different.
Yeah.
So that makes me think of
that. Yeah. And so then when I think about that, I think, okay, for apparent opposites to not be seen as a problem by my mind,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
To just experience my life without saying, this is a problem. Because that the fact of this duality or the fact of this apparent contradiction is a problem. The problem is that I'm saying that it's a problem.
Yeah.
You know, I was having a conversation with a person who has a role in the higher echelons of Zen Center, and we were talking about this, of how You know, what we so often struggle with are our differences, because we make them a problem, mm-hmm. you know, rather than just, they're just differences. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It reminds me of my favorite line from the Little Prince. One doesn't see well except in the heart.
Yeah.
And that's where you're, again, you're past your thinking mind, you're having a gut response, asking your gut, what's the most appropriate heartfelt thing to do?
Yes.
In this moment, at this time.
Yes. And actually, the emotional, our emotions are integrators.
Yes.
I mean, one of the other things I've been studying in my, you know, spirit work journey, you know, Daniel Siegel, who is a psychologist who writes about these things, talks a lot about that. And some of the other Buddhist kind of psychologist people right now are talking about it too, where the function of the emotional world is an integrative function. I'm kind of looking at you because I know you work in this world too. So chime in if you want. But yeah, I think that, you know, he was really a wise man, yeah. Saint-Exupéry, because the heart is, the opposites aren't a problem. In the heart, it's not a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like when, I mean, I always love the stories about the opposite, people from the opposite sides of the tracks who fall in love. I mean, I'm just totally, you know, West Side Story, Romeo and Juliet, you know, whenever there's the opposites, you know, and then they find each other, I'm always like, yeah. And I think that's part of it, in the heart, you know, and I mean, okay, I'll get really corny, like in West Side Story, I don't know how many of you are fans of West Side Story, but, you know, it's not a problem for them that they're coming from the, you know, that she's from the sharks and her brother is a shark and that he's a jet. Now, it's a problem for everybody else, and so they get killed. But for them, that's not a problem. They're very clear. Their heart is very, very clear. So, yeah, I think that's a really, the heart is a wonderful integrator. And I think that's part of what Reggie Ray's encouragement is to, rather than go up here with the problems, go down and touch and feel and let the wisdom of our emotional somatic realm help integrate some of these things that our mind really makes into a problem.
And so you're going to help yourself live that by being a flyer as well as a writer as well. Mm-hmm. I don't know what else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 And so looking, you know, rather than looking to the two paths and trying to intellectually figure out which one it is, some other, not that sometimes that isn't a good thing to do. Sometimes that's absolutely the right thing to do. But some of us get frozen there. And I think that's the thing to pay attention to. If one's analysis is being helpful, great. But if you find that it's making you stuck, then maybe it's time to go to the heart or go to the body or go to spirit, go to purpose. And I've seen many a group be able to transcend difficult stuff by connecting with the deeper or higher intention. And in fact, that when Shohaku was talking, that seemed to be one of his ways he was starting to find integration, was to think of it as that you do live in the world with the clear eye of the self, but that one that is completely connected with the universe. So it's kind of the, you know, to me that's like Sando Kai. That's the teaching of Sando Kai, is that it's not that one supplants the other or takes over the other, or that they merge into the same thing and become undifferentiated. You still have this clear eye of the self, but it's a clear eye of the self that is informed by and is connected with the universe.
Mm-hmm. That's fine for someone out there that might have a clear eye.
Mm-hmm.
And what I find that I do at the crossroad that is immobilizing is that I feel like I'm trying to see way down the road. And I get so afraid. And really when I kind of unravel that, it's a lot about doing harm. It's like, it's not so much, is this going to make me happy or think, you know, it's more like, but am I just kind of following this yearning and following this bliss, and where is this voice coming from and how can I trust it? It's like I get really kind of turned around by what I can trust.
Mm-hmm.
And I really resonated with the different things that different people said about the mind, because, you know, usually I can, when I kind of get in that tangle, I just have to stop doing that. You know, stop trying to look way down the road. And, you know, so I'm afraid to act, and actually I have to take a step, and then just, you know, realize I don't have any choice. But I think there's a couple things involved for me, and one is this urge toward resolution.
Mm-hmm.
Like looking way down the road, mm-hmm. and wanting to resolve, and how uncomfortable it is to just not know and have to act in a way. I hate that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like most of my life.
Yeah.
Well,
I hate to tell you, but the nature of bodhisattva is you hang out in the paradox, because the vows themselves are that very thing. It's the nature of the beast, is that, you know, sometimes we need to be under our covers eating chocolate. I was on my couch today under the blue blanket, napping and drinking ginger tea, and, you know, that's what I was doing. And then you take a breath and you step out your door and you do what needs to be done. And then maybe you fall flat on your face in the mud, and then you go, oh, here it is again. Okay. Yeah. But then maybe you also look around. Maybe you hear one of those geese calling, and you look up, and you go, oh, wow, look at that. You know? You look up, you look out, you know? Or maybe a companion gives you some help. That's, you know, part of the wisdom of the Sangha treasure is you don't have to do it alone. You can say, help. I need help. I can't do this. I can't do this. This isn't working.
I don't know how.
Paul Haller's story of the turtle man. Paul Haller told this story of this man who lived outside of San Francisco Zen Center. He was blind, and he would walk with his cane, and he would come to that big street, what is it, Page Street, or that big street that's right in front of the San Francisco Zen Center?
Yeah.
Huge, big old street, and he would just get to there, and he'd just stop, and he'd just go, "Help! Help!" And just wait until somebody came and helped him across the street. And then he got across the street. And he did that all the time. I forget why they called him the Turtle Man, but they called him the Turtle Man. And that's how, you know, that's how he did it. Help, I can't cross this big street by myself. I need help. Because we are changed by the journey.
Yeah.
We're not the same people. Well, I think that might be the final comment because it's time. So thank you for being here and studying this with me. I've just always found it to be a very fruitful thing to ponder. And it was nice to have the opportunity to go back and find Catherine's talk from 1999 about this. It was in the newsletter, so there is some copy somewhere of her talk about this koan. Okay, then. Thank you very much.